Hello and welcome to the In the Zone podcast with me, Mike Ryder.
And me, Josh Hughes.
And today also we have our guest, Luke Graham. Hi, Luke.
Hi, Mike. Hi, Josh.
Today we're going to talk about gatekeeping in sport specifically, because this is something that's got my goat recently. Regular readers, listeners will know that things get my goat quite a lot. I get annoyed watching football when there's this whole sort of discourse within the media around what it is to be a football person. So you'll hear in commentary about managers or about players, it's like, they do things the right way, or, oh, they're a real football man, or they're a real football woman. And it's like, it's this sort of gatekeeping idea of, well, what's inside the realms of what is considered to be a football person and what's not a football person. So a businessman comes in, they're not a football man. Like this, and it just really gets my goat, the way this sort of discussion pans out in the media. And then there's this distinction between, you know what you're talking about if you're a professional football person, football player, and you don't if you're not a professional football player. Mm. Discuss.
Well, yeah, it just seems to be that way in football, doesn't it? Because I think probably most managers are ex-players, even though there's nothing necessarily correlates between being a good player and being a good manager.
Mm.
In fact, probably some of the best managers weren't actually that good as players, were they?
Yeah, it's true.
So, you know, by that logic, then people who are good at managing elsewhere would also be good at managing in football, and people who are good at managing in football would be good at managing elsewhere.
Yeah, because you have to keep in mind that playing a sport and coaching a sport are two very different things, and some people are maybe very good coaches but not necessarily good athletes, and the reverse is true as well. Just because somebody's had a very prestigious playing career doesn't necessarily mean that they're qualified to manage and to coach and like to go for the nuances of all of that.
I was going to say, because there's been quite a change recently in the way managers are, their roles are described in the media as well, because it's not, you're not just a manager anymore. Like sometimes you'll have a coach, sometimes you might have a director of football. Mm. So there might be multiple roles within a company, or you might have someone that's in charge of transfers. I'm thinking like sort of Ed Woodward or the lady at Chelsea. I can't remember her name off the top of my head. But you know what I mean? So there's more than just a manager. It's not just as simple as being a manager, because the sort of, the major football clubs have changed so drastically over the years as well.
Mm. Yeah, and do you think that can lead to sort of competition between these managerial roles, and does it affect playing on the field, do you think?
See, what you mean, like the bureaucracy within the club, maybe?
It's too much?
I don't know. It's a good question. But then clubs are so multinational these days, aren't they? They're such sort of complex organisations, aren't they? It's not just like sort of 11 people on a pitch and sort of like a couple of people on a touchline anymore, is it?
Hmm. No, and I suppose there's also technology seems to be coming more and more into the game as well, doesn't it? It's not just 11 people putting their bodies on the line but even on the line. I mean, kicking a ball about, it's not really on the line, is it?
No, but like in the sort of discussion about sport, we always get this idea that it seems that sort of we build it up, we sort of overhype it for what it is, really, don't we?
Yeah, I remember at the end of the last, I think it was the final in the last World Cup, maybe 2014 World Cup, and someone was talking about this manager, he will live or die by that decision. He's not going to die. Yeah. What happened? He loses the football game.
I think I read like a really interesting like opinion piece a few years ago, and it's basically arguing that, like, competitive sport, and especially football, given how ubiquitous it is, it's played all over the world. It's probably the most played sport on earth. It's almost like the modern day manifestation of like gladiatorial combat and warfare and this and that. And people very much get behind their teams, whether it's a club team or a national team and this and that. And it's almost like a way of like expressing your identity and like wanting to win is like a very like almost like primal urge, I'd say. And it's like, so that's basically what I argued. It's that the modern day version of that, it's just that we've moved on from like maybe the more primitive forms of what we used to do.
Yeah,
and now we do it through sport instead.
Yeah, I agree with that actually, because I was thinking about this myself recently with regards to sort of, especially with regards to issues about racism. Mainly specifically because I feel like football is itself as a sport encourages a tribal mentality. Hmm. So if it encourages difference, it's probably more than any other sport I think that I know, actually, where it's very much a case of we're all supporters of this team and therefore this is what our identity is. You sort of share in that collective identity.
Yeah.
So it's like Liverpool supporters. They'll all have this collective sort of thing about Hillsborough, like whether or not they were even alive or whatever at the time. But that's sort of a part of the club's identity, which doesn't matter where you are in the world. That's sort of, it's a part of you. And therefore, if someone says something about Hillsborough, that then becomes something that offends you. You know what I mean? And then, so these clubs, they sort of they adopt these identities that their fans then sort of take on as well, which I think encourages this sort of me versus you mentality, which becomes really ridiculous at points, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's always strange to me about kind of regional derbies. Like, why do you hate someone? Because they come from the other side of town.
Yeah. I think it just depends on the individual. Like, some people, like, going supporting the local club or the club, if it's not the local club, is like what they do every weekend. It's how they socialise. It's where their friendship groups are. Like you say, it's a huge part of their identity. Mm. And so in that sense, you can almost understand why people take it to such almost maybe an extreme, and they like so firmly like plant their flag or like defend their colours or however it is you choose to describe that. Whereas obviously then there's the other side. There's some people who want a team to win and do well, but it's not the end of the world if they don't.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, it just goes off the scale though when it comes to football compared to any other sport. And I was trying to think about why this is. I mean, obviously there's, I suppose you could say, where's the more working class origins of football. And as a sport, I think it's probably the easiest sport to play. Essentially, you can jump as a goalpost, as long as you've got a ball. Yeah. Whereas with rugby, for example, you don't want to be playing on concrete. You're not playing on concrete. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? And also, like, it's far more physical, and often, like, the rules are really complicated. And so it's a very different type of sport to football, which is so easy, anyone can just pick up and do.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably a part of it, and sort of the way it's ingrained in our culture though, over the years. Yeah, I don't know where this sort of, it's almost like a hatred some people have for like other fans.
Yeah.
And but equally at the same time, if you saw someone wearing the same shirt as your team on the bus or something, you'd feel like you had some sort of close relationship, where you felt like you had an affinity with them.
Yeah.
And what is it about sport that does that?
I don't know. I suppose like the manifestation of the hate of other teams in its extreme is kind of football firms, isn't it? And extreme football violence and hooliganism, which.
But then you have to keep in mind as well, so that some football clubs, the identity goes beyond football. So, for example, Barcelona, very much linked to like the quest for independence from Spain.
Catalonia.
You have, and then, so they have a very deep rivalry with Real Madrid that goes beyond sport alone to, it's almost representative of nationalism.
Yeah.
And then obviously there's like obviously the religious tension historically between Rangers and Celtic and that sort of thing. And in that sense, the club became a way for people who had identities outside of football to group together with people that shared that identity, if that makes sense. So for example, like Catholics or Protestants in the Celtic and
Rangers
example. It gives them like a way to be around people from the same identity in the first place.
But to the point where football itself becomes like a religion, it almost replaces the religion.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole Catholic Protestant thing there as well, it got very mixed up with the nationalist sort of arguments as well, didn't it? But I mean, sort of the abuse people like Neil Lennon would sort of suffer would just be ridiculous, really.
Well, the fact that he has to have armed police around his house and stuff is...
Yeah.
It's a game of football, come on.
Like you say, like religion, I mean, there's not much difference from getting up on a Sunday morning and going to church as there is to going to a football ground on a Sunday afternoon.
You're spending far more money on football than
you're still making nowadays, that sort of weekly journey and to go and do the sort of the whole ritual of it, aren't you?
And then you have to justify doing it, as you say, so that therefore sort of repeats itself, doesn't it? So in your hatred for your rivals, or sort of like when you're sort of down the pub, you feel like you've got something in common with the people around you.
Well, that's another thing, isn't it? You go to sort of a most towns, and you'll go to a pub, and it'll be, oh, that's a Man United pub. That's a Liverpool pub.
Right. It's like you can't, if you went to the wrong one in the wrong shirt.
Yeah,
you've
got the wrong shirt.
Consequences.
But then, you're not even in Manchester or Liverpool. Why is a pub in Blackpool or in Lancaster or wherever? Why is it designated as a particular type of pub?
I think that links again to the idea of people trying to find people that are similar to themselves. So if a big aspect of your identity is that you're a Manchester United fan or a Manchester City fan, when you want to go and watch the football, you are going to, if there is one available, seek out a pub that is one for your club, because you'll be in a pub, you can celebrate with people that are going to celebrate like you're celebrating, and not really have to worry, oh, if I celebrate too strongly, someone's going to have a do at me or react badly to me because of that.
And it links to something that Dennis Bergkamp said, the great Arsenal forward.
We've never referenced Dennis Bergkamp in the podcast, it's the first.
He said something like, "You don't support a football club because it's from your because the town is because the club is in your hometown. You support a football club because that's where you belong."
Mm.
And it's kind of, I think that's.
Yeah, and it doesn't just apply when the football's on either, because as you say, this sort of whole pub thing is about identity, I think,
yeah.
as much as anything. And maybe working class identity, do we have identity anymore? Is this why, because we struggle for our identity, we sort of cling on to things like football clubs so strongly, as compared to, say, a rugby union club or a rugby league club?
Hmm. Yeah, maybe it does have to do with sort of, because I suppose there isn't really a British identity anymore, an English identity, is there?
No, anymore? And so, religion's on the decline, obviously.
Yeah, so to replace it with your allegiance to football...
And it's easier to give your allegiance to a football club than to a state.
Yeah.
Like, I don't necessarily feel British, but like I feel more affinity with my football club.
Yeah.
Does politics become a part of football? Is football taking over the role not only of the church but of the sort of state in a way that people behave? That they give all their money. They probably give more money to their football club than they do in taxes.
Mm.
On a yearly basis, these proper fans, the sort of
the ones home and away.
But then what's a proper fan?
Well, yeah. No, exactly. That's a good point. Right. I know. It's a loaded word. Yeah.
This thing, you know. I mean, I've never had a season ticket for anywhere. Hmm. So.
But depending on your club, you could have. So I know Liverpool, the waiting list for a season ticket there is years long. So like, some people, they're like gold dust to get hold of them.
Yeah. So some people, if you're on the waiting list or you've got a season ticket, you're a proper fan. Yeah. Right? But if you're not, and you just. Even if you watch all the games at home, and you know you support them, you love Liverpool or whatever club as much as someone who's got a season ticket, you're not a proper fan because you've not got a season ticket.
But then, like the argument like can be made. So like it sounds quite bad. Like I do enjoy like going to the stadium, like watching a game of football. But it's also really good being able to watch a game of football on the television and know that if you blink or if you pop to the loo or if you go and get a pint,
you can rewind it
and there's going to be replays of anything contentious. Like there's nothing worse than like being in a stadium and you think someone scored at the other end of the pitch, or you don't know if someone scored, or you're not quite sure what decision the referee's given, whereas on the television it's more instantaneous.
I remember going to watch Blackpool Football Club, Bloomfield Road. I missed every goal because I was waiting for a pie.
How many pies were you eating?
One, it was just a really big queue. It was so hot, I burnt my mouth. I wasted time.
this idea about the proper football fan is quite an interesting one, because I mean, we basically, I started with this idea that, well, there's a lot of gatekeeping in sport, and then we completely went off the rails and talked about something else. But this idea that either you are a proper fan or you're not a proper fan.
Yeah.
Like, because as you say, you're sitting at home watching a telly, you're paying a subscription. Your subscription's paying for the football, essentially.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, Premier League earns billions of pounds, isn't it?
Most of the money's from television. It's not really from the people filling the stadiums. Because ultimately, if every single fan of a club, you can't fit every single fan of a club in a stadium. So it's impossible. The idea that people that go to a football game are the proper fans is ridiculous. Because... If you can't make a stadium with a million
but
seats.
Do you not feel that links then to the people that are saying you're not a proper fan if you don't go to the games, and the people saying you're not a proper fan then if you don't go to every home and away game, you don't travel with the club? Those are the people that are doing that, and therefore they're almost in a way perhaps justifying the level of expenditure they're doing and the amount of time and resources they're investing in, like in something like the lower leagues. Like you might have like a 10-hour round trip to go and watch a game like down south, like in Brighton or wherever it is. Yeah.
Yeah. But it is, and then that perpetuates the mythology around football as in like these sort of, they're almost like the bishops and archdeacons of the church of Morecambe Town or whatever it is. Morecambe?
I think it's just Morecambe.
Morecambe FC are here, but I just saw them on campus just now.
Oh, yeah. Right. We've not got the new strength and conditioning gym. Morecambe, I have a bit of a partnership with us, and they're using our facilities and our training facilities. And I think there's potentially some stuff in the works for some other clubs that are local to be having a better relationship with us and with the university set up as well.
Hmm. Well, you heard it here first on the podcast.
Yeah. Well, that's quite interesting, because clubs like Fleetwood Town, they built their own strength and conditioning campus, basically, and then allow the public to use it.
Yeah,
so it's kind of the other way around. Which
but obviously not every club has the resources to do that, and we've just invested a lot of money.
So we've got to justify it.
Yeah. And it's a source of income as well, you have to remember. So the sports centre here is run as a business, and if someone's willing to come along and use it, not only do we get the prestige of having a professional or semi-professional club using our facilities, we also get a bit of income because they pay for that, or they pay us in kind, we get other benefits as well.
And then we attract students who...
potentially might have links with that club, and so forth.
Yeah.
But talking about proper fans,
yeah.
Do you think it also links to ideas of the proper way to play football?
Yeah.
Because what I'm thinking of is when Phil Scolari took over Brazil for the first time, and it, you know, before it was kind of the beautiful game throughout the 70s and stuff, and then there was kind of, everyone thinks that Big Phil Scolari for this sort of pragmatic shift, and it was a slightly uglier game, but he won in the 94 World Cup, I think.
Mm.
And in that sense, it was sort of, it wasn't the proper way to play, but it was acceptable because they won.
Yeah. And this is the thing with Mourinho. Well, Mourinho in his first spell when he was good. Because I am a Chelsea fan, by the way. but I am from down south, I should add. I have family from London. I am a legitimate Chelsea fan. But when Mourinho came the first time round, there's a lot of arguments about, he had all these really expensive, world-class players, like good, really good, talented players. But he played the football of pragmatics, basically. He just played, we're gonna score a goal, and then we're going to stick all these men behind the ball, and we're just going to drop
part
the front.
Bus.
Yeah, basically, part of the bus. This is where part of the bus came from, Mourinho in his first spell. But there's this sort of disconnect between, it's not the proper way to play football, but he won an awful lot of trophies. Yeah. And then that's what counts, isn't it? I don't know.
Yeah, but I suppose as well, it's sort of, the winning of a lot of trophies also links back to the idea of proper fans, I think, because... You kind of, there was a thing a few years ago about describing hipster fans, because lots of people decided to talk about the Makalele role.
Oh yeah.
Which I suppose is really just
now the Kante role now.
Yeah, but I suppose is really just a repeat of Roy Keane's The Prawn Sandwich Brigade.
Yeah,
these weren't proper fans, but somehow, but now someone who's not a proper fan, in inverted commas, still kind of talks about it with a level of analysis that you wouldn't have ever thought of that 10, 15 years ago. Someone who's not a proper fan would have been like, oh yeah, they're right, aren't they? But now it's a bit deeper, and it's a bit, but I suppose characterising someone who gives that sort of hipster analysis as not a proper fan is sort of, I don't know, it's strange. I suppose the casual fan has had to evolve a bit.
I think if you asked 100 fans from a club that's not won any silverware in a couple of decades, would you rather next season that we play beautiful football and finish mid-table, get knocked out of the cup in like the quarterfinals, and basically that's our season, or would you rather that we win every game 1-0, we win the cup, we win the league? I think any fan, whether they're a proper fan or what, if you support a club, you want them to win and you want them to gain trophies. I like playing as well myself. Like, I would much rather win ugly, but win and get promotion, and like the different things that may potentially come with that. So such as like better funding from the union or that sort of thing, at university level, than be like, oh, well, we had a good season, lads. We played some really good football, but we missed out on the league.
Yeah. But I think this goes with the unspoken idea that there's actually an ideal way to play football where you can win and you can play amazingly well.
Yeah.
Sort of like Barca when it had Neymar for those few years, or sort of what City are trying to do now.
Yeah.
But then also at the same time, there's also this awareness that can just backfire on you massively, because you had this whole thing with Arsenal and trying to walk the ball into the net, which is another famous sort of Arsenal-related football phrase, wasn't it? Yeah. Where it was just sort of tap, 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 didn't do anything with the ball because they were too busy passing it. You need a bit of direct football. So there's this tension almost, isn't there, between being effective and playing, inverted commas, beautiful football.
Yeah, and then sometimes you play against a team where playing beautiful football just doesn't work.
No.
Some teams are hard to do that against, and you have to be more direct, or you have to hit them on the counter-attack, or you have to do this instead. I think it's very difficult to be, we are going to play pure, beautiful football. And then the question is, what is pure, beautiful football? Like, it's like, my
massive is that holder,
England will play 4-4.
you can swear on the
two, yeah. But it's one of those, isn't it? It's like, there's different views, some parts of the world. So, for example, a lot of like the football in Africa, it's very much about the skill on the ball. It's perhaps more important than the passing and the movement. It's the individual flair on the ball.
Flamboyance.
Yeah, the flamboyance is maybe the right way of saying it, whereas maybe like, obviously in Spain, their version of football is, at the national level, like Barcelona played as well, is to pass the ball, to
technical,
move,
quick
technical,
passing,
very good. And so then that's also very subjective as well. You have to account for like the world, how wide-reaching football is around the world and people's different views based on that.
But it's interesting then, because you think about football and national identity, because you have this idea, we all have ideas of what Germans are like, but then we also have an idea of what the German national team's like, and then these two things often sort of intertwine, don't they? Because you think, oh, they're really efficient, they're methodical, they're really structured, they're like machines.
Yeah.
And then, like, in the German national team, we tend to like to see it like that, don't we?
Yeah. Then they put 7 goals past Brazil.
And you're just like, yeah. Because you think of Brazil as being, really creative, really sort of flamboyant, really. But then they've got maybe a weak spine, we don't know. But
then again, I suppose it doesn't really apply. Because the negative stereotype of the Spanish is that they're all lazy, which obviously isn't true. But it doesn't really apply to the Spanish national team.
No, but it does when they lose. And that's the thing. Yeah. Because when Germans win, they're efficient, sort of ruthless sporting machines. But then when Mesut Ozil plays and has a stinker, like they're suddenly not machines. They're lazy and like they're not the machines. Yeah. But again, it just plays to almost a game. We're sort of putting national type stereotypes onto football teams.
Yeah. What would you say would be the English national stereotype?
What, the long ball, hoofing it?
Well, our football team, we get a lot of bad press when we do badly, don't we? Like, individual players, some in particular, have faced a lot of criticism over the years for various things.
Wasn't when David Beckham ended up with that red card in the 98 World Cup, there was a national headline, which we hope you get kid cancer and your kid dies or something, wasn't it?
Really?
What
was the Venezuelan? No, the Colombian player called who actually got assassinated.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
Actually scored an own goal in the World Cup. Yeah. Was he Escobar?
I think that's right, yeah.
Yeah.
And there was also a thing where like North Korea lost, didn't they? And I didn't want to go home.
Sort of tried claiming asylum, I think.
But I suppose I don't really know what the English football stereotype would be.
I think English football over the past few years especially is very much trying to build itself a footballing identity in terms of this is how we play football, this is our approach and so forth. So obviously we have like Gareth Southgate is like a bit of a younger manager, British manager compared to maybe what we've had in the past. And especially as well, linking to that, the amount of resources and money and just everything that they've thrown into St. George's Park, like the centre of excellence and the training camp. It's all about, basically, this is how we're going to play football, this is our identity, this is our base, this is our home. That's how they describe St. George's Park. It's a home of English football. And it's this idea that they're identity building, in a way.
Yeah, but what is English football?
Well, I suppose it's because, like, a few years ago, you would have thought of what people called the golden generation, wouldn't you? Like, Gerrard and Lampard and Terry and Wayne Rooney. Even though every time they went to a major tournament, people expected them to win, and then they did terribly, and everyone was like, oh, of course we're going to lose. And then, you know, last World Cup, 2018, a group of youngsters mostly, people thought, let's let them have a go, basically, and then they get to a semi-final. Mm. Like, no one really thought that, but then there's quite a lot of stuff came out about Gareth Southgate sort of forming an identity of the team, wasn't it? And the team is a microcosm of modern England.
Because in the past, I've read things basically saying that there's always seemed to be a divide in the England setup between the players from like the top four, top five clubs, whatever it was. They didn't maybe play as well together as they could have done if they were able to look past that as individuals. It was very much your Chelsea, I'm United, you're this, you're that. Because they were such intense rivals week in, week out. And that's maybe not to diminish like the rivalries that exist currently. Between like the players,
but they're not so strong anywhere near so strong, are they?
But it's almost like that's reduced a bit, maybe.
But then, because I suppose the big teams have changed as well. Because I know City have got a few English players, but then they're not the ones leading like the line there, are they? It's not like you had sort of your Terry, your Lampard, you have your Gerrard at the set and Carragher, like at the heart of these teams.
I think it used to be there's maybe more stars in the older teams, like the golden generation, whereas now it's more like it's less an individual focus. It's more like they play as a team. Mm. Like there are obviously, they're all stars. They're all like top footballers, but none of them are maybe in...
I'm not sure where Eric Dier is.
He scored against Colombia.
Well,
absolutely brilliant.
Well,
but the, what's it called? The identity, it's not like, oh, we have this superstar player that's going to win the game for us. Like that's not the approach anymore. Like remember all like the furor around Rooney? When he got injured in the build-up to, was it the 2004 Euros?
Yeah, I think so.
When he was like 16 or 17 or whatever, he broke a bone in his foot and like all the national media attention was, will he be able to play? We need him. We'll do nothing without him. Whereas I feel we've moved away from that as a national team.
Is that just because of all the defeats as well, as much as anything, do you think? Because our whole national identity is now, actually, we're not king of the world anymore. Because I think back in the day, we used to think, well, we had this massive empire once, and we used to be world powers, but we're not world powers in any way, shape or form anymore. And equally, our football team's not either. Yeah. So
Maybe that is reflecting kind of the England team that went to the 2018 World Cup, in that it was, this is a microcosm of modern Britain. Yeah. Let's have a go.
We don't have any expectations whatsoever.
Yeah. But it's like you have to look at that team and you say, who's the superstar in that team?
I suppose you might say Harry Kane. But
Sterling, maybe.
It was injured, wasn't he, part of it as well?
Yeah.
Yeah, top scorer from just scoring penalties. But which was just like rubbish, really.
But Kane and Sterling are people you might say are the superstar, but they might not be on the day. And the rest of the team are just sort of solid players and solid workhorses.
Yeah.
Mm.
And then, and that gets the job done, basically, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And maybe that's, if the England team is a microcosm of modern England, then maybe that should be something we apply to the rest of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was thinking about the national identity idea that you were talking about, and then thinking, well, kind of, the English identity is kind of just a mishmash of lots of different things. Then that's actually kind of the English identity, really, because we're just a mishmash of lots of different cultures all sort of together in one pot, and we all sort of try and get along. Whereas I don't know. Cause what is the English identity these days? We're sitting here.
Three
white boys sitting here thinking, well, what is our national identity? But actually, I don't know. I don't really know that we've got one, have we?
Well, I suppose there's still the stereotype that we're sort of still a colonial power, or still approach the world in that sort of way. But I think that's kind of maybe the Brexit Party.
Is that our image?
Is the last hurrah of that? Not even hurrah, but the last.
It's like, how did the world see us as well? And
yeah,
I don't think very positively at all. No. I think there's obviously a lot of stereotypes associated with Britain, especially like America, for example. It's like you all have like the same accent, and you drink tea, and you do this, and you all have awful teeth, and like that sort of thing, like proper stereotypes. But then beyond that, I think it's very difficult, isn't it, to nail down what is English identity like.
Because we're so diverse, what is the English nation? We don't have anything to cling to these days, do we?
Really. And I suppose it's not at a national level, like the government projects or talks about British values, doesn't talk about anything English.
Yeah.
And I suppose you would expect that from central government, because central government represents Britain as a whole.
Mm.
But, there's still... devolved assemblies in Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland.
But there's nothing for England.
I think maybe
still project some
in
sort
England,
of,
it's more localised, like the idea of identity. So it's go back to Liverpool as an example. Like Liverpudlians see themselves as being very friendly, very talkative, you shouldn't really have any trouble out in Liverpool. It's the same so Yorkshire very much has their idea of what a Yorkshire identity is. And I feel almost in England especially, people don't so much say, oh, I'm English or whatever. It's more like I'm from this part of... I'm Mancunian or whatever, and you have, obviously the thick accent and this and that, and you're like, oh, yeah, we had Oasis, we had that. Whereas as a whole, I think England's just so diverse. It's very difficult, isn't it? It'd be so difficult to meet all the criteria of what Englishness could potentially be.
Mm.
Like, nobody has enough in them to do all of that.
Mm. Yeah, I suppose it's quite interesting as well... probably being from the north, I probably have more in common with people from Scotland or Wales than I would the average southerner, apart from Mike.
Apart from me. Yeah. I'm definitely not the average southerner.
Well, exactly. That's the thing, isn't it? Like, if a stereotypical southerner would probably actually struggle to relate to anybody outside of London.
Mm. Well, to me, anything above London's north.
Exactly.
I hit the north as soon as I went past Watford, when I was driving up here.
That's what you're saying, isn't it? Yeah. So, but I mean... So in that sense, there's a divide in what we could have constituted English identity from, isn't there?
Yeah, definitely. I feel as well it does help that obviously a lot of government, all power is basically centralised down south in London. A lot of investment is London-based. Like this HS2 is really to benefit London more than anything.
Yeah.
All the economy... really is based around the market, which is based in the City of London. It's just I think, is it the Labour Party have just said recently about how they're going to base parliament up north to try and spread move, power. Yeah.
They were going to move the finance stuff all up to Manchester, I think it was.
Yeah. Well, I mean, actually, if you wanted to have a British assembly in the most central part of the country, of Great Britain, it would actually be in Dunstop Bridge, which is about 5 miles away from where we're sat here.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Wow. Yeah.
Lancaster. So we could be the first assembly. Right?
We could be. We could have it.
But that's the thing with St George's Park. It's meant to be within 2 hours driving distance of everyone in England. So that's why it's down like in Derbyshire.
Right.
That's why it's there. It's meant to be equally accessible to everyone.
Mm.
But then its train options, like from up here, are just absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah. But then I can't imagine too many people at the FA get the train.
No.
But so yeah, so that's obviously gone off massively off rails from what we started with. But it's quite an interesting discussion, I think. So maybe this is part of the reason why we do cling so much to our football teams, as compared to other sporting teams, maybe.
Yeah.
Because they do give us identity. They give us some sort of localised identity that you can sort of cling to in the discussions in the office and at work, at school.
That's right. Well, also in just if you travel around the country. And you're in whatever you're a Liverpool fan or a City fan, and you end up in a pub, a Liverpool pub or a City pub.
Yeah,
you got friends there, haven't you?
Yeah, because I don't think you could do the same with, like you said, I support like Leeds Rhinos or follow Harlequins or whatever.
Yeah,
like people just wouldn't be able to. You wouldn't be able to have that conversation.
Yeah,
even people don't support football, I suppose, because it's like a language of our society.
Yeah, it's like for me, like if I'm ever abroad, I'm speaking to someone. And they're like, oh, where are you from? I'm always like near Manchester. And like, it's like the first thing that comes up is like Manchester United. Like always without fail. Especially if it's someone who's obviously they're a local and their English isn't the strongest.
They'll know that word.
Yeah. They know Manchester. They've heard of Manchester United.
Yeah. It's the same like me. I say like London. Depends who I'm talking to. You'll adjust it based on how much you think they know about where you're from.
Yeah.
So like, do you know Kent? No. Okay. Yeah, it's an interesting one. But so maybe this is also part of the reason why we do gatekeep so much, because if it's so much a part of our identities that...
Then it's really important to us.
Yeah. So you've got gatekeeping into football and gatekeeping into the club itself.
Yeah.
Because it still goes on to this day, especially football phone-ins. I mean, it just does my head in, really, just listening to these sometimes, I think.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking about it before, actually, when we were talking about quote-unquote real fans and how many people, at the start of a season, if an underdog team is doing really well... Someone will ring up like 5 Live, 606, whatever it is, and say, "Oh, we're progressing too fast. We shouldn't be doing this well now."
Yeah.
Like, what you seem to do badly. It feels in the same way, like fans of like heavy metal who want their band to be a really small band that they support and they can be this super fan. But if if it starts to become popular, then suddenly they're not as good.
Yeah. But I do always, I've always enjoyed watching on the Arsenal fan TV.
Oh, yes.
After match, like interviews, because they have become a meme now, and it's like people will sit and wait for it to get released just to see what's said. But it's actually really funny. And then I suppose that's maybe an argument for listening to the experts on football, because very often in those immediate post match like interviews, people have a lot of emotion and they come out with some absolute rubbish, don't they? That is just so ill-informed. It's just very much, this is what I'm feeling right now and I need to say it. I'm very angry.
Yeah. But then there's a question of, well, what is an expert?
Yeah.
Which I think is itself probably a question for another thing, because I think you can definitely distinguish between different pundits. Having played football and even having won things doesn't make you a better pundit than another.
Yeah, definitely.
And some journalists are a lot better at it than football players. So that in itself doesn't make you an expert. But yeah, okay. I think that probably gives us a nice place to round up. Thanks for that interesting discussion.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the In The Zone podcast with Mike Ryder and Josh Hughes.
For more podcasts and interesting chat, visit inthezonepodcast.com.